This is part 6 of a 6-part series. Carl Halvorsen grew up in Christiania, now called Oslo. In his 30s, he won Norway's highest medals for competition skiing, and later moved to Colorado. There, he made his living with the Ringling Bros Circus, making appearances sky sailing as the Sky Rocket. He was one of the first to introduce ski jumping to America. It had existed as a sport in Norway for about a century. In 1914, he built a ski jump in Steamboat Springs, where he taught the sport to locals. By now, he went by the Americanized form of his name, Carl Howelson, but he was lovingly called the Flying Norseman. He organized the first winter carnival in Steamboat, which continues to this day. It became an exhibition of skiing and winter activities in general, helping to popularize skiing as a pastime across the state. Now the centerpiece is the Lighted Man, a tradition started by Claudius Banks in 1938 when he attached working light bulbs to his ski poles and Roman candles to his helmet. Over time, the suits have become more sophisticated, but every year, Claudius's son, John, carries on the tradition of skiing down Howelson Hill, illuminated by electricity and pyrotechnics. Like a moment of passing inspiration, Howelson disappeared as quickly as he appeared. He returned home on a visit in 1921, fell in love, and left Colorado forever the next year. It wasn't until 1939 that the first commercial ski hill opened in Colorado, and it soon became an iconic Colorado activity. In 2022, Deckard Dean became the 100th person who lived or trained in Steamboat Springs to compete in the Olympics, the most from any American town. Dean is called the Flying Machine and carries on Howelson's legacy. Steamboat has become one of the most popular ski resorts in Colorado, finally providing a good reason to make the hour-and-a-half detour off of I-70. Personally, I'm not much of a skier. My favorite part of the ski day is soaking in the hot tub, and that's exactly what drew me to Steamboat Springs last September. In the hills above the town of Steamboat Springs, there's a winding, unpaved road that leads to the Strawberry Park Hot Springs. It's a bit of a misnomer, because it was never part of Strawberry Park, where the brief strawberry boom happened. There was a sign that read, Buffalo Pass, Strawberry Park, Hot Springs, and in the absence of another proper name, it became known as the Strawberry Park Hot Springs. When we visited, my partner and I joined in the proud tradition of skinny dipping after dark. As with the hot springs in town, the Crawfords suspected that they were the first to discover this spring because it showed none of the signs of human interference they saw around the barely lukewarm Sulphur Spring. Water leaves the mountain at a scorching 150 degrees Fahrenheit and cools down as it trickles down the hillside. The Crawfords didn't mention bathing in the spring, but they did make tea with it and use small pools to hard-boil and soft-boil their eggs. By the 1940s, the springs were known for their pain-relieving effects. At the time, this was attributed to the minerals in the water, but this is virtually the only health claim that's borne out from hot springs. Bathing in warm water does help soothe muscle and skeletal pain. These hot springs were owned by the same association as the hot springs in town, but they were left undeveloped and unwatched. In the 50s, it was common for locals and visitors alike to camp downstream of the boiling springs and create their own ad hoc pools, mixing creek and spring water to create comfortable bathing temperatures. As with all nice things, people ruined it. In the 1970s, the area's popularity had outgrown the forest's ability to replenish itself, and garbage and feces started to build up. House development had also encroached on the area, and conflicts flared up. Skiers and visitors saw the area as a hippie paradise where clothing was optional. Locals and families wanted a more family-friendly atmosphere and saw that overuse was destroying the Creek Valley. In 1977, at the town's request, police started ticketing nude bathers for indecent exposure, particularly if children were around. In 1982, the organization sold the springs to a Chicago-based developer, Don Johnson, who cleaned the area, built permanent bathing pools, and charged admission. Which is not to say that the nudity stopped, nor did the popularity with the old-timers diminish. One visitor recalled from the 80s,
I remember rolling up there with a crew of hot young ski bums and bunnies, getting naked in a teepee, sprinting to the hot pools, only to find a busload of equally naked seniors doing their thing.
The Springs became a more sober affair after March 2003, when a woman was found drowned there. Toxicology reports stated that she had a high level of alcohol in her system, along with cocaine and methamphetamine. Nowadays, entry is tightly regulated, and in the age of COVID, entry is limited to hourly blocks. That said, if you rent a cabin or campsite on the grounds, you can visit the pools after dark. And by dark, I mean dark. Poolside lights are minimal, and flashlights are frowned upon. Bathing suits are strictly don't ask, don't tell. Nearly everyone in Steamboat has a story about the hot springs, or some other spring that happens to be their favorite. The springs have remained at the center of human activity in the area, just as it was thousands of years ago. And as the population has grown, so too have the conflicts of interest over the use and preservation of the springs. The Soda Spring, which has also been called the Pagoda Spring and the Iron Spring, remained a popular meeting spot through the 20th century. Even in 1910, it proved a little too popular for certain residents.
Local news. If young people must spoon, let them remain away from the soda spring after 10 p.m., as the thirsty must drink. This applies especially to a certain barber. Why not take a chance at a more secluded spot, say the Milk Spring or the Navajo?
I find it interesting that this anonymous writer suggests other springs as the possible locations for after-dark canoodling. As with the Steamboat Spring, the Soda Spring constantly suffered from interference from visitors. In the Pilot, 1935, an article ran under the headline, Famous Soda Spring Has Returned to Former Activity.
The reopening of the famous Soda Spring near the Cabin Hotel is good news for Steamboat Springs. For years, it has been the favorite spring not only because of its nearness to the main part of town, but also because it is palatable and vitalizing. Mayor Luckins examined the spring last week, had the recess cleaned out, and found that the trouble was clogging of the inlet by all kinds of articles which had been thrown or dropped into the pipe.
It's clear that almost 30 years after the arrival of the railroad, Steamboat still aspired to being an indispensable destination. That same article states, without a hint of irony,
the water of this spring is destined to be used in all parts of the world when it becomes known, said a chemist who analyzed the water many years ago.
Unfortunately, the Soda Spring met with a very similar fate to the Steamboat Spring. In 1946, a two-lane highway was paved leading northwest out of the town. Highway workers excavating the road found a multitude of springs and sinkholes and evened them out by filling them in with asphalt. It was not the only modern spring to fall victim to construction. Lolita wrote in 1977,
when the modern highway disturbed ancient underground passageways, the boisterous flow of the iron spring was reduced to a few lethargic bubbles. Other springs, trampled by herds of sheep or cattle, or bulldozed under to make way for building industry, disappeared. Well-meaning people with little knowledge of or concern for the natural ecology filled native marshlands with tons of rock.
When the spring was again threatened in the 80s, Lolita picked up a pen to remind Steamboat of its past.
Originally, the Soda, Iron Spring, had a strong flow. It bubbled boisterously. When a storm was coming, it boiled out of its rock basin. The flow was cut when the present road was blasted. Though the spring still bubbles lethargically, most of the water apparently drains into the river. I am told this spring is again threatened by a projected highway. Unlovely as the spring is in its current state of neglect, I strongly urge that it not be forfeited. If you modern dwellers in Steamboat had enjoyed it, as did the old-timers, you would know it's worth fighting for. why not try to find the original flow? Funds are always found for town maintenance, road work, ski projects. Why not maintenance of the springs?
In 1988, the pilot ran an article, quote, "It won't hurt to move the spring," says officials, sharing the opinion of local and state geologists that the spring could be relocated out of the way of the highway extension without damage. They were successful in moving the pagoda, but failed to move the spring. In 1990, we get the opinion piece, "Eulogy to a Spring."
Toll the bell, lower the flag, sound the bugle, mark the grave. The soda spring in City Park, like the steamboat spring, has fallen to man's pursuit of progress.
That's right. A second landmark spring was lost to transportation. Today you can no longer sample the fizzy waters of the soda spring, although you can look into the sad hole in the bottom of the pagoda where it used to be. The next year, repairs to US 40 failed to restore the spring. At that time, the resident engineer on the project, Dale Pyle, was still hopeful.
Wondering whether the spring will pop up at a new location whenever road work is done.
He told the pilot,
"We probably ought to put a gazebo on wheels."
In that same article, he clarifies his first priority.
"It was a difficult job just to get stability on that section of the highway. We weren't 100% successful, but considering the amount of water under there, the results aren't bad."
This is how the situation sits today. Two famous springs have been destroyed, and countless lesser-known ones have been lost under buildings. In retrospect, it seems that creating a permanent settlement on such unique geology was always fated to be a hideously destructive process. Have we at least learned anything from all this destruction? Thankfully, the town has taken certain lessons to heart. Here's Danny, author of The Springs of Steamboat Springs, and Candace, director of the Tread of the Pioneers Museum, discussing recent efforts to protect the springs.
So that was kind of Candace Bannister's brainchild. She's the ED at Tread of Pioneers. And she came to me and said, "I know you're interested in the springs, and we really need to be doing more to preserve them and put protections in place for them." This is something she's been talking about for quite a while. So we met with the city of Steamboat Springs and felt that the committee should be under their umbrella, because that way it would have longevity. Whereas if we start it and one of us leaves, it could easily fall apart. So we worked with the city of Steamboat Springs to kind of come up with a framework for it. And then we went to city council and presented to them, and they were in favor of that. The city manager was in favor of it. And so as of right now, it is under the city of Steamboat Springs, and they are still kind of finalizing the structure and how it's all going to work. But the goal of it is that the committee will meet, having a variety of different interests in it that can look at the best way to protect the springs from development, to have better education about the springs, to have better outreach about them, so that in another 100 years, all the city-owned springs, at the very least, will still be here and still be protected.
And so that's really where the museum has come in to really put focus on this. We partner with Yampatika to lead Mineral Springs walking tours all throughout the summer on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. That starts at the Depot Arts Center on 13th Street, and you learn about each spring and really all about sort of why these are unique and how each one is different, and just a whole lot of history on that tour. In addition to that, we worked with several groups to create all new Mineral Springs signs. So if you want to do the tour or some of the tour on your own, there are great interpretive signs there with all new design, all new photographs, all new text. We re-researched things. We really found out a lot working with geologists. And so that's really a way that we're, you know, continuing to put the focus on the spring.
When I asked about the key to future preservation efforts, they both agreed. It's about making sure the town values the unique land that it's claimed.
If they love it, they will save it. And what we're talking about, I think, with cultural resources or natural resources is an understanding of that finite resource, understanding of how important it is to our community, and taking steps to actually preserve it, share it, and celebrate it.
Through the Tread of Pioneers, they do a tour of the Mineral Springs, and they get a pretty good turnout for it. But it would be nice for the people in the community to really see the value in it. Again, there's a few, but it's not seen as this like economic value to the community like the ski mountain is, and that's something that we've got to work on.
What we have found over time is that the springs have sort of taken a secondary role. We have so many wonderful assets about Steamboat, especially skiing, and that's really what sort of driven things here. So a lot of people who live here, they know our name is Steamboat Springs. They might know where our name is derived from. They may know that there's a stinky spring kind of making a sulfur smell in the downtown, but they're not really necessarily understanding or appreciating really that the diversity of these springs, the number of these springs, really put Steamboat on the map as like a small Yellowstone, if you will. I kind of call us like the baby Yellowstone, you know, with this incredible geologic area that isn't really getting the focus and attention on just how incredible it is because we have so many other things that we're sort of standing in the shadow of.
Unfortunately, some of the spring-loving old-timers have passed away between when Dani wrote her book and when I wrote this project.
From this guy, George Tolles, a lot of the research came from George Tolles, who was considered to be a water witcher. So he could take like the stick and go onto property and find where water would be for wells and stuff. But he was the spokesperson for the springs for like years and years and years. And he passed, I think, 4 or 5 years ago. But he was just one of those people that had kept all his notes. And when I was doing research, he said, you know, here you go. You're welcome to it. I mean, just so generous with it. So hopefully people are recording everything that's gone on in town now.
Ultimately, the forces that destroyed the Steamboat and Soda Springs are still at work. As long as capitalism demands perpetual growth and development, natural spaces will always be threatened. Towns like Steamboat depend upon tourism to thrive, and yet tourism threatens to destroy the things it loves from overuse. Here's Candace on the need to balance growth with preservation.
And I'm not pointing a finger at our Chamber of Commerce because they are doing their job, but they get on, for instance, a campaign initiative with Colorado Tourism Office, for instance, that said, hey, let's create a whole marketing campaign around a driving tour circle of the state featuring various hot springs. Well, it's a great idea, right? And it really took off. And then ever since then, this hot springs is cars all the way down the road. They cannot manage the parking. They cannot manage the crowd. They're now in a reservation system, thank goodness, and I think that's helped with a lot, and that reservation system started with COVID, as far as I understand, when there were limitations, you know, on number of people you could have in the pools. But it's a perfect example of where, you know, I think with the dawn of the internet and social media and really how much people are able to share information and their photos and their experiences, places that were really a little bit off the beaten path, like Steamboat, that were 3 hours from Denver, now I think a lot of these areas start to feel like the areas that you left, the areas that either you moved away from or that you're visiting from.
Conservation in white society has always been a project of a few concerned citizens pushing back against capitalism. Only loud, unified opposition from affected communities can tip the scales against destruction of their environment. And even then they often fail, as capital interests demand perpetual growth year after year after year after year. One method for pushing back on this is education. I came across this story because of the efforts of the Tread of the Pioneers Museum and the book The Springs of Steamboat Springs by Dani McKinley. Conservation is what drives people like Dani to tell their stories. The work of dedicated local historians enabled my research into this topic. I hope this piece serves as another link in the chain that connects people of today to the past by showing how decisions made over 100 years ago still affect the land and the people of today. By learning our history, we can better understand our relationship to these decisions, and in particular, the half-forgotten injustices that we continue to profit off of. Our ancestors arrived here, certain that they could make something of a pristine wilderness, but those changes have made human habitation in these fragile environments dangerously unsustainable. We can correct our vision of progress now, or after we've blasted the last mountainside, drained the last aquifer, and lost everything that makes this part of the world special. It's really up to us to decide. I can't say exactly what changes must be made, but I can say with confidence that we have been far worse stewards of the land than the people who lived here before us. The Ute had no desire to fill in marshland with asphalt or blast railroads into the mountainside. One of the biggest remaining obstacles to the projects of education and conservation is our own fragility. Because we identify with our forebears, it's easy to take discussion of their crimes against humanity and nature as indictments of ourselves and our society. The fact is that all society is borrowed clothes. We inherit it from our parents and we pass it on to our children. We can mend it and update it, but we have to get a good look at it first to find the problems. Fragility showed up in a surprising place when I started publishing this podcast series. Candace, who I'd spoken to a few times over the phone and over email, asked me to remove her participation from the podcast when she saw the series headline, "Why Did Steamboat Springs Blow Up the Steamboat Spring?" Here's her just days before the release of the first episode.
We've already ruined, and this is terrible, we've already negatively hurt, in some way or another, three springs.
But after the release, she wrote to me,
"They did not blow up the Steamboat Spring. I don't think it is a good idea to over-exaggerate. They had no intention of doing that. They were simply bringing the single most important transportation development of the time into our valley for goods and opportunities. In coming through the hillside and needing to blast, they inadvertently affected the adjacent spring's flow."
I've laid out the history accurately in this podcast, hopefully capturing the perspective that Candace states here while still holding the town responsible for their past actions. Am I over-exaggerating when I say the Steamboat Spring was blown up? It's true that they did not stick dynamite into the actual hole or do it for fun. They blasted feet away from the geyser that gave the town its name. Or is Candace now downplaying the facts because, stated plainly, they give a bad impression of the town? Please let me know your opinion in the comments. To me, it was an example of how a dedicated conservationist can still have surprising episodes of fragility when confronting the past. I want to end the series with Lulita, who has served as my guide back through history. She was born and lived most of her life in the Pritchett home on Federal Boulevard here in Denver, just blocks from where I used to rent an apartment. Her father, Carr Pritchett, was a leading mining engineer. She was originally named after her mother, Luli, but when her aunt complained about possible confusion, it was changed to Lulita, Little Luli, in Spanish, showing the enduring Spanish influence on Coloradans. What is now a thoroughly developed suburb in Denver was still rural in those days. Lulita wrote in 1983,
"When I was a child, I had this big yard to live in, and several nearby vacant lots that had once been an apple orchard. We dug caves, picked sand lilies, found horned toads, and climbed trees. We always had a dog and a cat. Roller skates were the style, and I had a tricycle. Then in the summer, we went to Steamboat."
Lulita graduated from the University of Denver in 1926 and taught there until 1930, when she quit to take care of her parents, who were now in their 60s. Her sister Margaret never had a job and also stayed at home taking care of the parents. Lulita eventually found the home too crowded. She wanted to go out and have adventures like her mother had, so she took another job a decade later, this time as a file clerk. In 1843, Lulita's father passed away, and in 1852, so did Luli. All along, Lulita had been writing diaries, poems, stories, and histories. She loved the town of Steamboat Springs, although she only lived there for 3 years of her life, and remained active in their current affairs, writing conservation-minded letters to the pilot and visiting often. In 1959, she published The Cabin at Medicine Springs, a 245-page fictionalization of her grandparents' settlement of Steamboat Springs and the night of the Meeker Massacre. It won several awards and became a well-read children's book in Colorado and the surrounding states. As I quoted earlier, it treats Indian removal as a sad necessity and shows a mid-century reframing of Indians as tragic and misguided, but essentially kind and sharing. In her way, she reminded Coloradans of what they had lost with the destruction of the Ute Nation. It doesn't appear that Lulita actually needed to work, having inherited plenty from both of her parents, including a stately house in a prime location of Denver, and the undeveloped plot next door. Nevertheless, she worked for 34 years, while her sister Margaret stayed at home. In 1972, Margaret passed away, and later that year, the house suffered a burglary while Lulita was at work. The loss of family heirlooms permanently shook her peace of mind. She added bars to the house and stopped leaving for extended periods, retiring from her job 2 years later. For almost 15 years, she lived alone. During that time, she compiled most of the original sources used in this podcast and wrote extensively about her family. She held on to family artifacts, transforming her house into a living museum. Her nephew recalls being politely but firmly told not to sit in the antique chairs. She served as the crucial link from her parents and grandparents at the turn of the 20th century to researchers like me in the 21st. In 1988, Lulita's health declined. Enormous development had taken place over the preceding years, and North Federal wasn't the prestigious neighborhood it once was. The Denver Broncos Mile High Stadium opened a mile down the street. The site was chosen because the neighborhood was no longer affluent and white, but middle and lower income and Hispanic. She sold the house to relatives and moved into a nursing home, and within a year, she passed away. She was 84. Her nephew, James Crawford, has since preserved her life's work online. A year after Lulita's death, in 1989, I was born in California and moved to the outer suburbs of Denver at the age of two. Over the next few decades, the area where Lulita lived hit its nadir. And then, in the 2000s, as downtown Denver was being extensively renovated, it again became a fashionable suburb. A wave of gentrification in the 2010s brought in young professionals like me. I was a copywriter at a local ad agency. The Safeway that Lulita saw as the beginning of the end for her neighborhood was my local grocery store. I frequently bike up the Platte River past Confluence Park, where Denver once eyed the slightly older town of Auraria across the Cherry Creek. Now, Auraria is a university and an amusement park, and the oldest houses of Denver are being transformed into boxy new condos to house the young professionals brought in by the booming industries of today: technology, telecommunications, and weed. Already at age 32, I've seen my city drastically transform. Rundown, ratty bars I played open mics at a decade ago are now rows of treadmills on the first floor of luxury apartments. Who knows what they'll be a decade from now? That's the fickle nature of the economy and the haphazard way that we decide what survives and what gets destroyed to make way for the new. I'm sure Lulita felt the same bittersweetness as she watched Denver and Steamboat Springs transform over her lifetime. In her late 70s, she collected her Crawford Pioneer Tales that served as a crucial source for me. In it, she imagines her grandfather looking out over Steamboat Springs near the end of his life in the 1930s. James Crawford's town never developed into the major city that he dreamed of. His miracle spring water never became world famous. But he had built a community. He had changed the world, if only his corner of it. He turned a Ute campground into a white settlement, and, for better or worse, he was proud.
Up in the Crawford House on the hill, Steamboat's first settler sat on the wide porch where he could look out over his valley. The sturdy legs that had carried him across the Rocky Mountains for half a century would now carry him no farther than the front gate. As he puffed at his after-breakfast pipe, he could see the thin smoke rising from numerous stovepipes in the comfortable community on either side of Lincoln Avenue, where once he had seen Ute campfires. Moving his chair to keep in the strip of sunshine, he noted how the swallows were gathering on the electric wires. Sign of another winter coming. The early scarlet of autumn sharpened the hills above the Steamboat Spring, the hill from which he had long ago dreamed a dream. The vision was still afar off, but the sun was warm across his knees. and he could reach his hand to Maggie, who was never far off, and remind her, "Mother, we made the town."